everyone. Welcome back to the Earthdawn Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters. With your questers, Josh and Dan. I'm Dan.
I'm Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things quizzical, as we have an all-email episode for you. Email Palooza number umpteen million, 11 billion, something like that, whatever. I've lost track, and I don't care to count anymore. So there we are with those. Josh, any announcements to make before we get deep into the weeds?
The only thing I want to mention is that today, as we are recording this, so a week ago as you're listening to it on release day, even longer ago if you're not doing that, several of the sessions and panels and stuff that were done at FredoniaCon a couple of weeks back have been uploaded to the FASA Games YouTube channel. So if you missed some stuff, I haven't gone through to see what all is exactly there, but I know at least one, if not both, of the art sessions that James did one Saturday and one Sunday morning that weekend are up there. I know because I saw sort of like the preview show up on my YouTube page.
Fair.
The one with the Tuskrang was put up, and all of the videos for like the longer sessions are usually broken up into two parts because of recording stuff that basically meant we could only do like an hour for each thing.
Understood.
Anyway, if you're interested, check those out.
Totally. That's all. Love to see art being done in the process. Always helpful. Okay, first one up here, I believe, is from Rob. All right, all of these are like lengthy emails, so this is why it's going to be just an email episode today. Hey, Josh and Dan, been meaning to email for a while, but I'm behind in everything, so it's taken a bit. I'm just sending this now while I'm thinking of it, fresh after having the delightful experience of joining Josh's game in FredoniaCon this year. And he's talking 2024, in case you're out of order on your listening.
Yes.
I game master and do the editing of the Name Givers Earthdawn Actual Play podcast. But before I get to that, I wanted to throw a shout out to the Radio Free Earthdawn Actual Play podcast, who has been releasing weekly episodes for a while now of their Mists of Betrayal campaign. It's really well edited and fun to listen to. I also look forward to it each week. Just over a month ago, our podcast, Name Givers, returned from an unplanned hiatus. We're at 85 episodes now for that campaign, plus some bonus episodes. Good on you, Rob.
Yeah.
We started playing pre-pandemic and are still playing once or twice a month and probably have about 30 sessions worth of content that is recorded and not yet released. One of our regular bonus features was the one-shots we did at FredoniaCon every year, and we've now moved these to a new podcast feed where we plan to release short-form Earthdawn actual play adventures. So anyone seeking more Earthdawn but wants to hear something on the shorter side, check out the new feed called An Anthology of Adepts. Currently, it has 9 episodes that encompass 3 one-shots, roughly 7 hours of content there. But we plan on adding more to it later in the year. Last year, we finished our first session of our 1879 actual play called Boneyards and Boojums. The season encompasses a single complete story in 5 arcs. We tend to be on the narrative side as it is, but the 1879 game is especially so. So if you enjoy the storytelling side of actual play podcasts, do check this out. I think it might surprise people how much can be done with that system and setting. Here's a link for the show notes. Josh will put that in the show notes there. For future Earthdawn Survival Guide podcast ideas, I've had an idea percolating in the back of my mind ever since someone wrote in asking about the house rules that seem to be present in all, or at least almost all as far as I can tell, Earthdawn actual play games. Namely, the declaration of actions phase in combat always being skipped. I have a short answer for this. It keeps the narrative flow better for the listener and just feels like a better flow for an entirely online game over Discord.
Yeah. Depending on one's approach to how you want things to work from a combat standpoint, the declarations phase may have greater or lesser utility. There have been some things done with it across the various editions. I know that in 3rd edition, and possibly in earlier ones, but I know it was kind of a big deal in 3rd, is that the declarations phase was somewhat important because if you changed what you declared, you either had an increased difficulty number or got a step penalty or something like that. I don't specifically remember which direction it went.
Yeah.
That is sort of a thing that is important. And there are issues that come up with regards to a declarations phase prior to rolling initiative and then determining the results of everything that takes place that round. And that's something that's sort of an issue with combat in general, where in order to manage it, you have to break it up into little discrete chunks when actually everything is sort of happening at basically the same time. Different games have had different ways of trying to address that or solve that over the years. And personally, I tend to gloss over the declarations phase as well. The only times that it really sort of matters to me is when the character is intending to usually take a stance, like aggressive or defensive stance, because it does affect the target numbers and steps that they might be rolling during the course of the round. Waiting until they have their action might end up being kind of a moot point if you've got somebody who's going slowly and taking a defensive stance, but they don't get those benefits until their turn. There's some messy stuff, and you just kind of need to trade off with what works best for you and your group.
Agreed. No worries. So the idea in my head for future episodes would have to be some guest game masters on the show to talk a bit about how they approach either Earth Dawn or other role-playing games they may be known for. Maybe do this every few months, state on the show in advance who the guest will be, and ask for some listener questions, which would presumably be Game Master questions. I feel like the game can only grow by as many Game Masters are out there willing to run it, and it'd be great to hear questions or stories from listeners who want to Game Master but haven't yet, or want to become more confident in their skills. I also don't think it needs to be limited to those who run Earth Dawn. So much of Game Mastering is about how you approach running a game, and it's less about the system than people might think. My favorite game master doesn't run Earth Dawn at all, but I've learned so much from her actual play podcast that I was able to apply to my own Earth Dawn game mastering and our own podcast that I rarely get stuck in any way anymore.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. That involves a bit more guest wrangling and stuff, which we have done a couple of times.
A few times, yeah.
But probably not something that I would see us doing super frequently. Like every few months, yeah, maybe. If we can get enough
guests,
people to sort of draw on for that. And I do kind of like the idea of possibly bringing in other voices to offer advice or answers to questions or things like that. The Crit Show, which, as I have said multiple times, I am a big fan of and mm-hmm. decent friends with the cast and producers of that actual play.
Yes.
As part of their Patreon content, have a monthly show called Hold 2, which is, of course, a play on the Monster of the Week mechanics, where, you know, if you roll investigate a mystery and you roll really well, you hold 2, you get 2 questions that you get to ask about the nature of the monster and the mystery and stuff like that. Anyway, monthly show called Hold 2, where 2 members of the cast answer questions that had been submitted by members of the community, and they kind of talk about them. And it's sometimes about Monster of the Week or other Powered by the Apocalypse games. Sometimes it's just more general game mastering questions. I mean, it's sort of like what we do a little bit with our email episodes where people send in questions and stuff. But I am happy to entertain questions about game mastering in general. And I think the possibility of occasionally having a guest on that could offer their own insights or advice would be interesting.
Agreed.
So we'll take it under advisement.
Thank you, Rob. Ultimately, I'd love to hear some more actual plays being made of Earth Dawn. I'm always happy to help anyone out if they reach out for advice on this, if there's ever any emails in about that. Thanks for all you do. I don't think I've missed a single week of listening since I found it in December of 2019. Rob.
December 2019, that was pretty much when we started.
That's, I think, when we launched it, yeah. So yeah. It wasn't long after that, no.
Well, I think we started in, like, the end of October or beginning of November of that year, so we hadn't been going for very long at that point.
Agreed.
I have flirted in the back of my mind with the idea that if ever this show wraps, that if we find ourselves exhausted of Earth-Dawn content,
Earth-Dawn content.
That maybe shifting over to producing an actual play of some sort, that is a very different beast in a way than what we're doing.
Agreed.
But I think that could be interesting as well and would be sort of the next thing that I might consider tackling. Time, the problem is that you add more people and the complexity goes up even more and everything.
The logistics of just getting schedules together for a regular session.
Yeah.
And all that jazz.
So there's like two things that I sort of have in mind. One would be a regular podcast actual play release schedule, which does not require the cast to be beholden to all meeting at the same time every week or every however often it is, versus a streamed game where you do kind of need to have everybody together at the same time. There is actually a possible split the difference of that where you record it as if you are going to be streaming, but you release it on whatever particular schedule that would be so that you can work around people's lives and stuff like that. But yeah, that's like, oh, golly gee, if I had like an extra 2 days in the week that I could work on stuff and didn't have 13 other plates spinning.
Exactly. You and me both. Okay, here comes a little bit from Lehman. Our old friend Lehman, how you doing? Hello, Dan and Josh. I wanted to get this email to you for the live FredoniaCon recording, but time constraints delayed it. What's that like? Because, you know, neither one of us knows what that's like either. But here are my questions and an Earth-Dawn story at the end. Question one. When discussing the various care types, you presented scenarios of cares, such as being successful, being breached and destroyed, being breached and taken over, etc. And the episode went into detail on the various traps and defenses that cares used. The case of a care being breached, but the horrors driven off, was not discussed. Which at first thought made me think that the care builders just didn't understand the various defenses would ultimately be worthless. But thinking about the Bloodwood in the live podcast, the mention that Trevar was breached but survived made me wonder if this scenario, breached but successfully defended, was something that happened other than the two examples given.
Yes, I'm aware right off the top of my head of at least one other, the Vorst culture. They're described in the original Denizens of Earth-Dawn Volume 1. They might be reiterated in the Namegivers of Barsave book, or the Namegivers Compendium, or whatever it was called from Redbrick.
Yeah.
But it was a community, it was a culture that was residing in a care, and the care was breached. I think part of it was because they had built their care in like a volcanic, like active volcanic area, and they didn't ward the lava entrance. Like they had access to lava as something that was a feature deep in the care, and they didn't bother warding it because they didn't think that anything would be able to come through. But there were horrors that were able to breach the care that way, and the community spent quite a bit of time defending themselves from the incursions that came about as a result. And it shaped their culture in a very particular way so that, you know, now that the scourge is over and they are outside, they still have this very kind of fatalistic survivalist mentality, very sort of pragmatic, practical, brutal in the sense of not to each other, but just brutal in the sense of you put your opponent down or they put you down.
Fair.
That's one. There's not really a lot of detail on them, but I imagine that the tribesmen, or the Kathan of the Servos jungle, they didn't use the traditional Theran cares and defenses, but they did hide away in tunnels and cave systems below the Servos jungle. And I imagine would have needed to defend themselves from things that might have found their way into them. But the culture as a whole survived. So, yeah, that's a perfectly valid scenario that we didn't really talk about.
Fair.
Generally speaking, for that to have occurred, what you need to think about in your design of the care is the incursion happened, the care was breached to an extent, but they drove it off. How did they repair or restructure or do things in the care to replace that protection in those things? Did you have a situation where, kind of like an old style castle, you had layers of defenses? The outer level was breached, people could fall back to an inner one and kind of seal off that inner section on its own. And how would that have affected where resources were made available and so forth in terms of living area and food production and water and all that sort of thing? Because if the inside area didn't have everything that they needed, then that was a death sentence. So that is something that you would need to keep in mind when you're thinking about the design of the care and what might happen. The design that was developed for Jarrus, that was talked about in Empty Thrones, is a design that is sort of based a little bit on that idea, rather than as you had with Trevar or with Kratos, where you had sort of one single domed citadel that protected the entire community.
Mm-hmm.
Jarrus actually, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, was three sort of separate smaller citadels that were interconnected by tunnels below ground. And each was self-sustaining enough that if one of them did happen to fall, they could cut it off through those connective tunnels and keep the other ones potentially safe.
Yeah.
So there are certainly some design ideas and whatnot that you could think of. You just need to factor in how does the care survive if it's breached but drives back the enemy, and just factor in how that might go and how that might affect the culture and the people that survive such an event.
Question two from Lehman. The next question is about Battle Shout, changing gears completely. It states, quote, each use against the same opponent in a given encounter increases the difficulty number by 5. Is this based on the shouter or the target? The example that came up in this session is that we were attacked by Sky Raiders and 2 different Sky Raiders battle shouted at the same target in consecutive rounds. Would the second Sky Raider have the difficulty number raised by 5 based on the target getting shouted at twice? Or since it was different raiders and the difficulty number increases, require the same shouter against the same target?
That is a very good question, actually.
Hence the reason it was asked.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and look at original wordings from first edition and stuff here.
Yeah.
But while I'm pulling up the book, I'm going to mention that personally, I have always felt that it was from the individual user of the talent, so that a second Sky Raider doing the battle shout would not be penalized for another Sky Raider having already targeted them.
Fair.
That's the way that I had always envisioned it. Obviously, I think in fourth edition, the wording is probably not specific or clear enough on that. But Fair. Let me see if an earlier version of it did.
Well, remind me what battle shout does.
So battle shout is a talent that is primarily classically associated with Sky Raiders. I think other disciplines may get access to it as an option.
Yeah.
The adept rolls charisma plus their rank in battle shout against the social defense of the target.
Yeah.
And in fourth edition, each success causes a stacking penalty on the target's actions.
Okay. So it's meant...
It's a fear/intimidation.
I was going to say, so it's like an intimidation type effect. So yes. I was going to say, overall...
It's, I think, -2 per success in fourth edition.
Mm-hmm.
And it only lasts one round, unlike Taunt, which is a kind of similar effect, but is not fear-based.
Yeah.
Or intimidation-based. But Taunt has a smaller penalty with a longer duration.
Fair.
Taunt lasts for multiple rounds, but I think it's only -1 per success instead of -2. I'm not looking that up specifically, but I'm pretty sure like that's the major difference between them.
So the question is, each use against the same opponent increases the difficulty number by 5. So if you're going to battle shout them a second time, your difficulty number would be 5 higher than their social defense.
Again, going back to the first edition book, because I often like, when questions come up, like to go back to the original text.
Yeah,
see to see if there is something that, through the various edits and whatnot, did not get carried over to the new version, whether that's because it was an intentional change or something that seemed self-evident and was not carried over.
Yeah.
According to first edition, the only limitation of Battle Shout in first edition is that a character may be affected by only one Battle Shout at a time, which is in fourth edition kind of the standard. If there are multiple instances of the same effect targeting you, only the biggest one matters. Yeah,
the most successful wins.
But it actually doesn't have anything about the increasing difficulty.
Agreed.
So that's not something that was original. Although the original did require a good success against the target in order for Battle Shout to even be effective in the first place.
Fair.
So that is something that has changed over the editions. I think the difficulty level has been brought back, has been brought down to standard social defense. And I think the increasing difficulty is just to inure the target to kind of give them resistance to the effect, that you just kind of eventually get a little bit inured to the effect of a Sky Raider screaming in your face.
I think that was
obviously someone with a Sky Raider with a high rank in Battle Shout is still likely to be affecting people fairly easily. But I don't know off the top of my head at this point where, because I'm pretty sure it existed before fourth edition. So I'm thinking that the Battle Shout difficulty increase probably showed up initially in third, possibly in Classic. But I'm not going to go digging that far into my books to figure it all out. So I'm going to say, off the top of my head, I would rate that as it's based on the individual's adept using the talent, that is the shouter use against it, rather than the target. A target can be successfully battle shouted across multiple rounds by different characters with the talent.
Fair.
I may revise that. I actually have a little rules questions document that I keep going and periodically will, if I'm not sure, do some research and talk to the other members of the team about it and say, hey, this question came up and I'm not really sure. Here's how I'm leaning. What do you guys think? And just kind of like stress test and think about the consequences of what a particular ruling might end up with and getting, you know, multiple sets of eyes on it.
Yeah. I try for Earthdawn, especially since everything's fairly well laid out almost all the time. I try to go with the narrative, the intention behind the talent. So I think the Battle Shout is meant to, as you said, intimidate the target. So I think the target's hard to be intimidated twice. So therefore the difficulty number is raised by 5 because of the target. But that's my thought there. But the second Sky Raider having the difficulty number raised by 5, I don't know.
The trade-off there is what is, and here's what I'm thinking of. Like, usually in a typical player character group, only one character, maybe two, will have Battle Shout as a talent.
Fair.
And so what you would end up seeing in a situation like that is the Sky Raider, because they're usually the one that has it, if they're going up against another group, kind of rotating their Battle Shout through the various opponents. But if you think about sort of Sky Raider culture and how you would have a ship's worth of Sky Raiders kind of attacking, the consequences of the increased difficulty being based on the shouter has a different outcome long term than it being based on the target. Because if it's based on the target, then what happens is you mostly get the Sky Raiders showing up doing their Battle Shouts sort of in the initial round or so to unsettle their opponents, to be able to kind of do like broadly a blitz style thing where they come in and kind of smash really quickly and knock everybody around.
Yeah.
Which is like one way that it could go. Or if it's based on the shouter, then you could have the effect of the intimidation being able to last longer as different Sky Raiders kind of trade off who they're targeting with their intimidation.
Fair.
I'm not sure ultimately what the situation I would ideally expect to see from a setting standpoint be on that.
Fair.
Both of them hold a certain amount of appeal. I had always kind of questioned why the original version of Battle Shout required a good success, especially in comparison to Taunt, which was an equivalent, roughly equivalent tier talent.
Yeah.
That had a bigger bonus and lasted longer and was just gone against a standard social defense rather than a higher difficulty.
Yeah.
That was always weird. And I think a lot of other people kind of felt the same way, which is why its difficulty was scaled back in subsequent editions. But I don't know. Those are some vague, unformed thoughts. Well, not unformed, but so some wandering thoughts about Battle Shout in general. So that example of my thinking of, well, here's what the setting consequences are if you do it this way. Here's what they are if you do it this way. That is something that is not necessarily a concern when you're house ruling at your own table.
Fair.
But when you're developing stuff for or making rules calls for the game as a whole.
Yeah.
You need to think about what that would mean if this sort of thing were able to be rolled out on a larger scale and how that would affect the way that, for example, Sky Raider assaults would occur.
Agreed. So sorry we didn't stick the landing on that one. we'll get there. Josh will bring that up. Question three, longer question than even the first two. One question I had was about non-adept humans and versatility, which you answered in the live podcast. The Game Master and I agreed it seemed strange for ordinary humans to have the mystical talents, although the Game Master was intrigued at the possibilities of us encountering non-adept humans and underestimating them. And then we thought about Windling Astral Sight, which did seem appropriate. I thought maybe a compromise would be for non-adepts that these racial features were skills instead of talents, in which Astral Sight would just be a Windling skill, and versatility for humans would allow skills to be learned and skill versions of talents. At talent legend point cost, being cheaper in time and legend points. Of course, for NPCs, this wouldn't affect anything as Game Masters can give any NPC any skill they feel needed. But lore-wise, it would explain how humans can adapt easier to roles that a community needed, as John's thinking was leaning towards. For example, humans could learn a handful of skills easier than non-humans through human versatility.
I guess. That's starting to get to the point of the game isn't based around the idea of playing non-adept humans or advancing them as characters or any of that stuff. So I wouldn't see the need to mechanize or define the game mechanics by which that happened. As a concept, I don't really have a problem with it. But again, because NPCs being created by the Game Master can be made mostly however you want, provided that it makes a sort of amount of sense. Like, you are very unlikely to run into a 16-year-old who has melee weapons at rank 8.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have some kind of semblance of what's going on there. I certainly would not make that any kind of official rules mechanic for non-adept humans. Because, again, non-adept humans are not what the game is about. Arguably, it might be something worth considering if you have a character who, for some reason, is really set on, say, playing a non-adept questor, and you're looking at a way to possibly help balance them against other adept characters. But then at that point, you're starting to stray out of what we are focused on as far as the overall design of the game. I have to say that I understand the thought of, oh, well, Windlings, like all Windlings get access to Astral Sight. Yes, but that's not a skill. It's still a talent because of the division between, essentially, for it to be magical, it has to be a talent. Like, that's kind of the definition of things. But I don't know that I would necessarily even be that nitpicky about it because it's purchased and advanced as a talent for Windling adept characters that don't otherwise get access to it. Lore-wise, it seems like maybe an interesting idea, and I think I kind of talked about that in the sense that humans end up finding a way to fit into whatever niche is not being fulfilled within a given community or culture that they're a part of. But I don't know that rules for doing that are necessary. You wouldn't have to do that with a player character because they'd be an adept and they would just use the regular rules for versatility. You would need to have special rules for them that allow them to do things because they can already do them. So, yeah, maybe the idea that they can, in a limited fashion, pick up some skills at a lower cost. Conceptually, I don't have a problem with it, but I also don't feel the need to really focus too much on the rules aspect of it because I don't think it's something that's actually going to affect player characters in a significant way.
Yeah, fair enough. So, story time from Lehman. Going back to the episode on character death, I wanted to share what happened in our group recently. A goal of our human shaman was to take a shrieker bat as a companion. We found a cave where they lived and had a fun misadventure of craziness capturing one of them while all the melee adepts were on the ground due to the screeching. We realized that parts of the cave were worked, and thinking and expecting we found a lost care, went deeper into the cave after handling the bats. We went deeper and came across an unexpected life rock that had cracks in it and a large black metal spike driven into it. My obsidian sky reader, Feldspar, lost his temper at the sight, ripped out the spike, and flung it aside. The various magicians using astral sight and my obsidian doing whatever touching, communicating, understanding about life rocks got the information that this life rock was dying from a bleeding wound, and there were two sources of very faint life within it. The spike had basically caused the life rock to go dormant, and the removal of the spike was like pulling an object from a puncture wound, causing it to bleed out. We were in the middle of nowhere, and it would take about 4 days travel to a city and 4 days back to get help of other obsidian and or elementalists to try to save the life rock. My obsidian handed his troll sword to one character and his troll axe to another, dropped his pack, looked at his companions, grunted, "Remember my legend," and merged with the life rock in hopes that his life energy would be enough to heal it. The magician saw his threads and being unwoven and reweaving with the life rock and the living crystal armor that he wore repaired the cracks in the rock. The life forces within the rock grew stronger and one seemed close to emerging. The companions waited at the life rock as they mourned the loss of their companion, the elf scout and windling air sailor, especially teary-eyed and full of emotions. The next evening, an obsidian swordmaster was born. This was in no way expected or planned to switch characters. It was a thoughtful choice that affected both the player, me, and the character. I made the decision that the character, even with his Hulk-like rage, always simmering below the surface, would feel the life rock and future generations of obsidian were more important than his single life. The trauma that the life rock experienced erased its name from history, and as the legend spread, future progeny will be called the Brotherhood of Feldspar. I have no clue how official or canon this interpretation of life rocks is, but I think the Game Master gave a great story with an important moral choice and an unexpected character death that was meaningful. Thank you for all the Earthdawn Survival Guide podcast, and congratulations on 200 more episodes. Lehman.
That's a cool story. My biggest problem with it is the Obsidiman Sky Raider. I have the same feeling about that as I have about Obsidiman Air Sailors, fair, which is that everybody seems to want to be one, to be different.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to do something against the grain. I know, I'm going to make an Obsidiman Air Sailor. It's just one of those things that shows up a lot more frequently than actually would happen.
Yes.
I think originally in first edition.
Oh, yeah.
Obsidian could not be air sailors they couldn't be air sailors because they didn't exist in the core book, but they couldn't be sky raiders. Like the Obsidian.
Yeah, they had some limitations. They couldn't be beastmasters. They couldn't be thieves. They couldn't be archers. They couldn't be sky raiders.
Yeah, there were quite a number of things that they couldn't be.
Yeah.
And I understand. And even to a limited extent, agree with the lessening of racial restrictions for the disciplines.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that that suddenly makes a certain combination that was prohibited before more common. And it's more the fact that as a longtime member of the community and person who has heard a lot of stories of different characters over the years, I've heard about a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's like the scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian, where he opens the thing and all of the followers are there, like, waiting for him.
Yeah.
You're all individuals. And they're like, yes, we are all individuals as one.
Yes.
Feels like that sort of thing. That's like, yes, oh, how clever. You're playing an Obsidiman air sailor.
However, welcome to now playing an Obsidiman swordmaster.
Yeah. They Obsidiman couldn't be swordmasters in the first edition either, but I have much less of a problem with that.
Yeah, because they could be warriors, so it's tangent.
Yeah, because it doesn't necessarily require the connection with air and flying and the sky that...
Mm-hmm. Air sailors and sky raiders do?
Obsidiman kind of have a pretty strong aversion to. It would be like having an Obsidiman boatman, to be honest.
Yeah, fair.
I understand the desire to make something special, but when you're in my shoes and you have seen this special thing, every adventure proposal or source book or whatever, we see this cropping up. To be honest, we have an Obsidiman air sailor in the Legends of Barsave.
Yeah.
Adventures.
Yeah.
He's the sort of air sailor mentor that's in one of the adventuring companies. But I'm pretty sure there's probably one or two in Trevar. They like show up all mm-hmm. over the place. And I just like, I feel about it like I feel about immortal elves. They are cool.
They're far too ubiquitous.
They're far more common than I really think they ought to be.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a different thing when you're talking about your home game if you only got like one mm-hmm. as opposed to the broad setting where it seems like everybody wants to throw their own unique spin on things, but those unique yes. spins are in fact all very, very same. Similar.
Yeah. I only ever had my Obsidiman get on an airship if he owned ground boots, because it's a
yeah, that was an item that was introduced in first edition somewhere that was basically like
yeah.
Obsidiman don't like to fly unless they've got these because they lose their connection, their sort of spiritual, emotional connection yeah. with the earth.
And I still played him as like an ADD person on way too much caffeine, just like twitching. Get me back to the ground here soon, then I'll be happy. That's how I played mine.
As far as a story goes, fantastic.
Love the idea.
Loved the whole sort of arc there, the like decision being made in the moment, not a planned sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how it may have happened, but even like necessarily stepping back for a moment.
Yeah.
Out of character at a meta level and saying, okay, here's what I think my character yeah. wants to do. How are mm-hmm. we going to play this out and deal with it? I think fantastic. I think it's a wonderful story.
I love the problem. I love the solution. I love the character exploration in that. I love the explanation of what exactly happened and the results therefore for just the legend alone.
Yeah.
Beautifully done.
It's a fantastic story. I just,
yeah.
I needed to go off about flying Obsidiman.
Yes, because we do. Anyway. Okay. So last email, because I know we're already like more than half an hour into this. How far are we? Yeah, 40 minutes into this already. So this is from Conrad, who is well behind on his listening. So we need to like tag Conrad here real quick and tell him we have an answer for him. Hi, Dan and Josh. A couple of topics for all things quizzical, if that's okay. It absolutely is, because you're the first, second to third, whatever. Does it mention quizzical? One, armor. Spelled with a U this time. Are there any restrictions in the fourth edition for who can wear what armor? I could not find anything on restrictions or drawbacks other than the initiative penalty. And encumbrance, if this is something one can be bothered to track. If so, do all mages run around in full plate armor, as the extra protection seems much more useful than a few extra steps in the initiative roll? All of the illustrations in the book show mages in robes. Is this just a fashion statement?
Multiple parts to that question. The first part is yes. No, there are not any real discipline-based restrictions on what type of armor one can wear. It is entirely based on how much you are hampered, both from an initiative and carrying capacity standpoint, to determine what you wear.
Welcome
in one of my earliest Earthdawn games, one of the characters was an orc wizard
mm-hmm.
who ran around in chainmail and actually carried an axe, pickaxe, I think, but
yeah.
an axe. Like, they did not look like a spellcaster at all. The artwork does have a lot of wizards in robes, and part of that is the tradition of wizards originally, or not just wizards, but spellcasters in general, mm-hmm. needing to weave their spells into their robes, that their robes acted in a way as kind of like an extension of their grimoire.
Yeah.
That their spell matrices were matrix items that were kind of a part of their robes. And so the robes of a magician are a kind of traditional presentation of
their knowledge,
ability and knowledge and status as magicians. And the fact that the elaborate embroidery and stuff that was part and parcel of that also acted to demonstrate that they had the dedication and mindset and whatnot to practice a craft and present something beautiful plays into a whole lot of different things. I don't know that a lot of magicians would be running around in plate. Most characters don't run around in plate, just in general. It becomes a matter of how much your character can carry and how much they are willing to penalize themselves when it comes to their initiative step, their dexterity. I certainly would not have a problem with magicians who can do it wearing heavier armor. Because, yeah, magicians do tend to have lower dexterities on average. They do tend to be acting later in the round on average. And having that physical protection, especially in 4th edition with the changes to how armor-defeating hits work, makes that extra defense, that extra damage reduction that armor provides, a little bit better. Also, magicians may tend to not have quite as high a toughness, and so their wound threshold is slightly lower. And so being able to resist that extra point or two of damage from your armor might mean the difference between taking a wound or not. It was a lot less of a case in earlier editions where armor-defeating hits were all or nothing. And this was a problem not just for magicians, but for any character that ended up having a lower dexterity step and thereby a lower physical defense. Because when you got into higher experience levels, higher circles, higher tiers of play, the opponents and the attack steps that would be able to be made against you would tend to outstrip your physical defense enough that it would give you an armor defeating hit frequently enough that it probably wasn't worth having armor in the first place, because the armor would just get bypassed so frequently.
Fair.
Ultimately, there aren't any restrictions. It is largely tradition and what the individual is capable of doing.
I have three thoughts to add on this one. First off, welcome to the beauty of Earthdawn. When I went to go sell it to my group who'd been familiar with D&D, and they said, well, what can I wear as a mage? I'm like, whatever you want. There's like, do armor restrictions?
Whatever you can afford and whatever you can carry.
Exactly. They were like, oh, I'm going to like this game. My wizard can wear so-and-so. My elementalist can wear it. Yeah, do it. If you can afford it, go for it. So that was the best selling point right there. I already had them hooked from like the second page. Secondly, in the last Earthdawn adventure I was in, my character was befriended one of the other players' characters who was a dwarf elementalist in full plate. His initiative step was a D4 minus 2, and so he almost always went last. Just saying.
I would be very reluctant to lower my character's initiative to that step. I certainly would see dwarf or orc or troll magicians wearing heavier armor compared to humans, elves.
Yeah.
I continue to fall back on the feeling that overall, if you know, in terms of trade-off of protection versus initiative penalty versus other stuff, that Blood Pebble is probably, while not necessarily the best armor, a really, really good, solid, all-around armor choice
for
just about anybody.
Yes. Great way to go.
Especially if you can get some work done on it to forge it and increase its protective capability.
Absolutely.
The number of characters that I have seen over the years who, the first time after they get caught without armor, like during a night ambush, decide to get Blood Pebble at the next opportunity.
Yeah.
Is well worth it. And I think the next step up from that, which is the Living Crystal, tends to be a little bit too pricey and not quite as worth it.
Agreed.
From a balancing trade-offs kind of thing.
Standpoint, yeah.
The only drawback to Blood Pebble is that it is expensive and it causes blood magic damage, which if you're a magician with a lower toughness means that you are even closer to those kind of danger points. But
yeah,
once you get a couple of circles under your belt, it's not necessarily a huge problem.
Yeah, cost benefit analysis on Blood Pebble. Mwah, beautiful. Not gonna lie. Anyway, so those are my little thoughts to add onto that one. So second question is going to be a longer one because there's multi parts to this. It's of a moral philosophical nature. One of the drawbacks of Earth Dawn has always been the lack of colored illustrations. I agree that black and white pencil style art has its undeniable charm. However, in the 21st century, where a lot of games move to virtual spaces, cool and interesting tokens for both heroes and monsters are a kind of a necessity. And Earth Dawn's iconic art does not translate well to that realm. As people working with artists and making money from creative ventures such as writing, what are your thoughts on using AI and AI-generated art for personal use? Ever since the rise of Midjourney, I have been using it to create tokens for Earth Dawn, trying to match the appearance of monsters and horrors to their descriptions in the books. I have subsequently learned about how AI is trained and how blurry the line is between its creations and outright plagiarism. What are your thoughts on this, please? Also, a sub-question, are there plans on more high-quality official art which will come in virtual tabletop-friendly formats?
I'm going to try and keep my rant about AI short here.
Okay.
We're like pushing time and I could go on.
We can spend a whole episode on this one.
I'm going to try and like limit it to the question as much as I can.
Thank you, Conrad.
If all you are doing is using it to generate NPC portraits or tokens or things like that for your own personal use at your table, whether face-to-face or on a virtual tabletop, if you're using them on your own, you're not selling them, you're not, like, giving them away.
You're not publishing.
Okay with that. I kind of recognize that at this point, the generative AI genie is out of the bottle.
Yeah.
In some aspects, we're gonna need to learn to live with it. I have quite a number of problems with it. One is that it's not really AI.
No, it's not.
In any definition that I would generally accept.
I call it aggregate intelligence.
Maybe. It's like a much fancier version of the predictive text from your phone.
Yeah.
In some respects, I mean, the art aspect is a little bit different, but when you're talking about something like ChatGPT.
Yeah.
The big issue that I have with the output of generative AI in general, and when it comes to visual art illustration in particular, is that because it is trained on the internet, right, mm-hmm. on the vast amount of art that is online,
yeah,
and what it's doing is it is seeing and numerically probability calculating these things kind of go close together, and it tends to like blur everything in and have it all end up in some cases kind of samey. Honestly, try and get a Tuskrang out of Midjourney.
Or an Obsidiman. They're really kind of
hard. Or an Obsidiman. Or an Earth Dawn troll. You can maybe work it out in getting something, but there's not enough data mm-hmm. in the learning set
yeah.
for the AI to recognize what that means. And even if there were, it is so completely overshadowed by the vast amount of D&D style fantasy yes. art that a Tuskrang is noise within that data set.
It's not going to come out correct because everything else it's gathering is homogenizing it.
I don't like the way that the training stuff happens. I think there are a lot of arguments that are being made in favor of generative AI that don't really hold water for me. Mm-hmm. I also think that there are a lot of people just in general, and this isn't something that's new, but just broadly speaking, you know, broad cultural trends, particularly in the like Western capitalist hellholes that we live in, that does not value the work of creative folk.
Yeah.
The work of writers and artists, mm-hmm. the work of actors and performers and the people that work to create the entertainment
yes.
that we enjoy. While there are a small number of people that are incredibly successful and incredibly wealthy as a result of the work that they do. The vast majority of people working in those fields quite often struggle to get by. I mean, remember the writer's strike?
Yes.
From last year and some of the news that came out as a result of that. And the Screen Actors Guild. The percentage of people that are part of those trade guilds that don't make enough or don't get enough work to be able to afford the union provided or to qualify for the union provided health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of actors working as part of the Screen Actors Guild make less than $20,000 a year from acting. It's some kind of number that you hear and you go, wait, what? Yeah, maybe the average salary is higher, but that's because it is skewed so badly by the handful of multi-million dollar actors, your Brad Pitts, your Tom Cruises, your
et cetera,
Harrison Fords, that are able to command
paychecks,
eight-digit paychecks for their work. But that's not the vast majority of people.
No, it's a pyramid. There's very few at the top and a lot at the bottom.
The producers, the companies that are behind it all, you know, I'm not talking just about movie studios here, but just in general, like big publishers, conglomerates,
record companies,
all of those sorts
movie
of things,
companies
would love nothing more than to be able to increase their bottom line by cutting the human element out of it. If they don't have to have employees, if they can get something that is able to produce pages and pages of
content,
script or content or artwork or whatever, and it doesn't have to take breaks and it doesn't ask for vacations and it doesn't ask for health insurance and blah, 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 they would absolutely love it. That like gets into my whole like artistic look. I recognize broadly speaking, those of us who are part of FASA Games.
Yes.
We certainly aren't getting rich at this. I am not unpaid, but the amount that I make in relation to the amount of work that I put into it.
Yeah.
Is way out of proportion. You know, it's the kind of thought of a novelist, right, working on their novel is putting in a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, when you factor in rewrites and editing and all that sort of stuff, is putting a lot of their time into their work. Is the amount of money that they get paid out of it a fair wage? There's a reason that a lot of writers are teachers or have some other kind of side gig or have a partner slash spouse that has a job that is actually able to support them.
Yeah. 40 hours a week
rather than the whole thing with AI. There's a lot of end stage, late stage capitalism nonsense that's all tied up in it.
Yeah.
It's already out of the box. I think that there are some potentially useful use cases for AI. I think the ones that are getting all the attention are not really the best examples of those use cases. They're just fancy and neat because, oh, I can type a couple of sentences and it gives me this picture and continues to sort of devalue the time and effort that goes into a creative person, an artist, whatever stripe you might be, that it takes to practice and hone
your craft,
your skills and your craft.
Yeah.
That saddens me. It doesn't surprise me. It just saddens me.
Yeah. I've played in a game online where the game master knows that they don't do art. They are putting together a story. And so played around with AI, got a couple of images, put them on there. This is who you see. This is who you see. That's it. Went nowhere else. I have no problem with that.
Yeah. It is no different than going online back before we had generative AI and grabbing a screenshot, a picture from a movie or TV show of an actor filling in that visual role or finding artwork from another game book or whatever that you feel kind of depicts this for your home game and stuff. That's fine. Fantastic.
Do it. Whatever.
Go for it. But from a commercial standpoint, I don't like it.
No, to give you an idea, we called our trash company today to see what we could do to negotiate the rate down because it had gone up a little bit. And they said, by the way, if you set up automatic payment through your bank, you'll save $8 a quarter because we pay quarterly. In the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, you want to get rid of your accountant who's actually taking all the checks that we mail you and processing those. You'd rather just have it come out automatically. So you want to get rid of your accountant. So to your point about this removes...
It's not the accountant. It's the clerk in the front office that's opening all of those envelopes. Exactly. I kind of recognize that on the one hand. Like, I recognize some aspects of automation and computerization and stuff has done wonders for improving efficiency and requiring fewer actual people to have their hands in something.
Yes.
I just wish that the benefits of that were shared with more than the top couple of hundred people that own all of the massive conglomerates that rule our lives.
Yes. No lie. I don't disagree in anything.
All right.
That wraps up this.
Thank you for listening to Josh and Dan bitch about capitalism.
And we'll get off our soapbox now. Until next time, get off. Hit us up on your soapbox and tell us what you got going on your end. We'll see you in the next episode, folks.
Good night, everybody.